Atlanta.
This is NPR.
Support for news comes from T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com.
A lot happens between 9 and noon.
There's so many things that are going on.
I'm so honored and pleased to have his endorsement.
We're going to settle for a country where a shrinking...
I don't think it's a civil war yet.
This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. We're talking politics, college costs, and what happens in Wisconsin now that Congress has said yes to the Stillwater Bridge. The Friday roundtable at 9, DESA, Britt Robson, and Bob Collins.
And Carrie, on the rewind later, whenever you watch a movie about journalism, they just get the journalism wrong.
Boy, have I noticed that.
We're going to hear about that.
And at 10, how do you know what you can afford when it comes to college? Hey, Ruth Hayden is in the studio, in depth on that at 10.
Always a popular guest. First, a check of regional news, Carrie. Minnesota school districts continue to dip into reserve funds and borrow money to make ends meet in light of payment shifts from the state. Gary Amorosa with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators says the payment shift continues to put financial stress on districts.
And it's important that our community members know that this was not a situation caused by the school board or by the administration or by the employees of the district, but that it was a result of the shift.
Last year, lawmakers delayed a portion of payments to schools to balance the state's budget. Districts will get the money starting this summer. This week's budget surplus announcement took a small bite out of the money owed to schools, although it still totals $2.4 billion. State Senator Gary Kubley of Granite Falls remains hospitalized in stable condition after suffering what his family describes as cardiac-like symptoms. Kubley is in his third term representing his western Minnesota district. He was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease about a year ago. Police in Rochester say a toddler has life-threatening injuries after he was stabbed by an intruder. The boy was stabbed in the abdomen yesterday morning. The intruder also stabbed a 26-year-old man who tried to intervene. Police say the mother of the toddler had a prior relationship with the suspect. The suspect was also treated at the hospital for injuries he had inflicted by a police dog. The suspect is now in the Olmsted County Jail. Carrie, that's the latest on the Daily Circuit.
Now in depth on the week's news.
Neon burns a hole in the night and the freon burns a hole in the sky. You can find my kind living right on the fault line, eyes on the sea.
This is the Friday Roundtable where we invite three guests into the studio to talk about the week's developments, controversies, and interesting moments. Today, we're going to talk about the Senate vote on contraception, a longtime moderate's decision to retire from Congress. Yes, they're connected. The Vikings and much more. In the roundtable hot seat, you heard the music, Dessa. Singer, songwriter, author, just back from a tour with Doomtree. She's going to talk about ethics, hip-hop, and social justice tonight at Augsburg College. But she's here this morning. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks, Carrie.
Britt Robson's with us. He writes about music, politics, and sports for SportsIllustrated.com and for the Star Trip. Britt, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Yeah, nice to be here.
And Bob Collins is here. He writes the News Cut blog here at NPR. Welcome back, Bob.
Can you believe how much awesome you got in one studio?
And you.
Britt and Dessa. That like defies some Einstein theory.
I know. Isn't this great? Yeah. Hey, if you have topics that you'd like to throw into the mix on our roundtable today, 800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Dess, I'm going to start with you because you're making this speech tonight at Augsburg. And this is a very interesting intersection that you're stepping into. Hip-hop, ethics, social justice. What are you going to say to bring that
to tie
all
them
together?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I initially got the invitation to speak, I thought it was spam because it seemed such an outrageous invitation. But hip hop here in Minneapolis, and I think in a lot of other communities, has a really strong tie to community work. You know, when I was first getting into the scene, even as an artist, learning the clubs, learning who the kind of reigning talent was in the city. As soon as I started getting my first shows, there were invitations to volunteer at schools and other artists saying, hey, you should come with me. We're doing a youth program. Or you should come with me. We're speaking a little bit about gender connections. Or we're going to an after-school community center that helps at-risk girls. So it was really built into the fabric of the culture for me, the kind of commitment to community and social justice. And I think it has been for a lot of artists.
You know, I was watching an old interview yesterday with President Obama in which he was talking about hip hop. I bet you know which one I'm talking
I'm
about.
I'm nodding the slow nod. Yeah.
And he said, I love the art of hip hop. I don't always like the message. Main concern, materialism. This focus on getting stuff, keeping stuff, how much money, how many cars. And, you know, there will be some young people, I think, in that audience, and then there will be some who are very familiar with hip-hop, and then there will be some people in the audience who don't know much about it. Do you talk about that?
Yeah, and in kind of drafting the PowerPoint, you know, that I'll be using today to accompany.
Are you using a PowerPoint?
I am. It's 2004 PowerPoint, so solid kind of ninth grade level there. But in assembling some images and some sounds from hip-hop culture, locally, regionally, and nationally, one of the biggest and I think most important decisions I made as I was trying to collect all this material was I'm going to resist the impulse to speak about this in binary terms. The question, is hip-hop good or bad, is less fruitful, let alone less interesting, than what work does hip-hop good do for social justice, and what are the regressive ideas in it? Because I think there certainly are some. And I don't say that from a place of self-righteousness, and I've got all the answers, because I don't. And doing this presentation challenged a lot of the beliefs that I went into it
Why?
Be frank. So, as you probably know, Carrie, and I've got some serious objections to not only the materialism, but the culture that degrades and dehumanizes women, not just objectifies, not just says you're sexy and I'm only worried about your body, but says it would be weak of me to acknowledge your humanity. And also the totally regressive ideas that you find in a lot, though not most of hip-hop, or excuse me, no, not all of hip-hop, about homosexuality. So I was researching online to grab a couple of especially egregious examples of those harmful ideas about homosexuality and women. And in the process, some of the artists who were using what I think are the most deleterious and harmful words were so charismatic in other interviews, were so funny, were so sharp. And it reminded me actually of the Olympia Snow resignation,
yeah, right,
because I thought it's so easy to villainize this dude wholesale when I haven't actually spent any time with him. Does that mean that he is excused for some regressive ideas? No. But it means probably that it's not honest and it's not productive for me to say, this guy is a villain, end of story. This guy's funny, he's effective, he's charismatic, and he's got some really regrettable public messages about homosexuality. And that kind of position, I think, also is a better position to start a conversation about change than, you're messing up my kids, I hate you.
Right. I'm glad you brought up the Olympia Snow thing, because that's where I want to go. And I do see the connection with what you've just said about that. And Britt and Bob, get in here, because Bob, you've been writing about this. This idea, and part of the reason that Senator Snow has decided to step out, I think she said the Senate has become so small. And in some ways, I think she was also saying the politics have become so small because they are portrayed in such black and white terms, and there's so little nuance left in this.
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons that has happened is because it has worked, at least as a short-term strategy. You'd have to say that in 2008, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party had the Republicans on the run. The Republicans had just essentially ruined the economy with the economic proposals they had. And whether you consider it a machination of the Koch brothers or a true grassroots movement, you had this blowback on Obamacare, and you had this intense passion mixed with this intense party discipline that knocked off guys like Mike Castle in Delaware with Tea Party candidates. And so I think what you wound up with was this tsunami of passion, and in an off-year election, that passion got people into the Senate and the House of Representatives that might not otherwise have gotten there.
Yeah,
and so as a short-term political strategy, it worked.
But Britt, when I look at the politics going on, there are purity tests on either side. I don't think this is just the GOP pursuing this.
Oh, I think if you want to talk equivalence, I think that the GOP is far more radical right now than the Democratic Party. I think that you can't really say, I mean, you've got a president of the United States who in his last stimulus proposal specifically called out almost everything he said was these were past Republican-supported proposals.
Look how mad the liberals are at him. Look how mad the Democrats are at him.
And look at the fact that he's the favorite to win the election. I mean, I think that...
Well, it is early days yet. Okay.
But I think the point I'm trying to make is that if you anger your left base in the Democratic Party, it doesn't mean that you will lose the election. If you anger your right base, you will get primaried and you have a good chance of losing. And I think that I don't think any rational observer can look at the two parties over the last 3 or 4 years and say that the Democratic Party has swung as hard to the left as the Republican Party has swung hard to the right. I just don't think you can make that equivalence.
Bob?
I try not to pay much attention to politicians anymore, which is odd because I used to run the political unit here. But I like to pay attention to the people who follow politicians because I think they are a better snapshot of where we are than what the politicians have to say. However, Olympia Snowe had an op-ed in today's Washington Post, which I wrote a little bit about today, and I can't believe what I read today and where it came from. But anyway, what she said, if I'll just read one paragraph, she said, "The great challenge is to create a system that gives our elected officials reasons to look past their differences and find a common ground if their initial party positions fail to garner sufficient support. In a politically diverse nation, only by finding that common ground can we achieve results for the common good. That is not happening today, and frankly, I do not see it happening in the near future." That's an incredible statement for a United States senator to make, and what I wrote on 5x8 today was, that's somebody giving up on democracy and the way a democracy works. That is frightening to me. And the response that one of the comments immediately was to say that she needs to clean up her own house first because she was too tied to the leaders. And Politico had a really good nine votes that she made that angered the leadership. So there is plenty of evidence that Olympia Snowe's bona fides are legit. And already in the discussion about that op-ed piece today, we're ignoring certain facts in order to create our own and create our own reality. And I think that's just frightening.
You were going to say?
I was gonna ask Bob for a memory jog, perhaps, but in reading about her resignation and then in the piece published today in the Washington Post, towards the end of the piece, she mentions that in addition to kind of the nobility and the effectiveness of compromise, we have to make sure that there's a political incentive for that kind of compromise.
Sure.
Which to me sounded like a little bit throwing a gauntlet down to the voting constituency, right? But also I think here on NPR heard months ago a commentator mention the importance of the fact that so many of our elected officials now do their time in D.C. and then go home to where they really do their living, and how perhaps some of the dramatic polarization that we see is a product of the fact, like 50 Cent, right, that I'm not seeing you quipping charismatically at the bar afterwards because I'm on a red eye home. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that resonated with you at all. As the kind of resident expert with me, I thought, gosh, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I think there is I don't know Washington at all or frankly what it's like to be a politician. But we've talked about this before, Carrie, sitting around our cubicles. There is a lack of any humanity now between lawmakers and politicians. Some people say the lobbyist rules have stymied any chance to get together. You know, it was a big deal 2 years ago in Minnesota, I think it was 2 years ago, maybe more, when the Senate president up here at the Capitol and the majority leader went bowling. Because it was so unusual to have any kind of social interaction between people. And so you end up with I think in the U.S. Senate, 100, ideologues and not 100 people.
Bob, I was going to say, I don't know if it's just the socializing, although I do hear people say that. Some of it, I think, is what you have to say to get elected and then what you are expected to fulfill once you've been elected.
And that's on us.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the media. Britt?
But I do think that it comes down to credibility. And to the extent that it is on the media, it is the media calling out when something, when a position is factually accurate or not.
Right. Yes.
I mean, if Mitt Romney comes on and says that President Obama is abandoning defense and our defense spending is collapsing when, in fact, it's going up significantly. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's many, many other examples. I think that what you have, in my view anyway, is you have various media that are propaganda arms, and they are putting out things that are factually inaccurate oftentimes. And you have people believing that lack of you know, these essentially what it comes to lies.
Britt, it's not just the propaganda, though. And we've been talking about this within the Daily Circuit this week, because Jay Rosen, a professor at NYU, has been really holding National Public Radio. Have you been reading some of the tweets, Bob?
Yeah, I'm not a big Jay Rosen
guy. He's been holding National Public Radio's feet to the fire because he has a campaign against basically he said, she said kind of journalism.
Good.
And urging, I think, precisely what you're talking about, Britt, with give us more of the information. Don't just, I've got the one candidate over here who says this, and then I've got the person that disagrees with that. You decide.
Go to the facts.
And actually, it looks like there is some change going on in the way people are reporting. You know that journalists worry about that because of getting too much of an editorial voice into the middle of something like that. So we're figuring that out.
But I think that if you constantly try to search for the middle at the expense of what is happening before your eyes, then you're going to be committing a far greater journalistic sin, which is basically not reporting the truth.
Right.
Emma, that is the first obligation of all journalists, is to reflect the facts on the ground as we know them best, rather than to try not to upset anybody on either side.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he said, she said is the direct result of fear by reporters and editors.
Right.
And is that fear heightened by the kind of changing news climate where it's harder and harder to monetize the product that you're providing?
I mean, personally, I don't think so. I think at the front lines, reporters don't really care about monetizing.
No, it's really stuff it's that pressure
much.
Coming
but, yeah, I
from
think
all the different special interest groups that are saying, I heard that and it wasn't.
And
it
it's
wasn't
compounded,
objective.
I think, by the fact that we seek data or news that confirms what we already believe.
Sure.
And that's then that gets back to the media being, marketed. That's where the monetizing comes from, is when the entire structure of a particular media company is targeting a particular political demographic.
The echo chamber.
Yeah.
Right. We have to take a quick break here for news. If you've just tuned in to the Daily Circuit, we've got our Friday roundtable going here. Dessa is with us. Britt Robson is with us. Bob Collins. I want to talk about the reaction that Minnesota Public Radio got to airing a Grover Norquist speech, because Bob wrote about this and we've talked about it in the newsroom. And I think we may have a listener who wants to talk about that as well. But Tom Weber here with the latest. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. Police are on hand today as students at Chardon High School in Ohio return to class. It's their first day back to class 4 days after a teenager shot 5 students in the cafeteria. 3 of the students died. One of the funerals will be held tomorrow. President Obama says he's not bluffing when he insists it's unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. The president told The Atlantic magazine that Iran and Israel both should know he means what he says. Obama will meet Monday at the White House with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The president wants Netanyahu to postpone any plans to attack Iran's nuclear facilities in coming months. Obama says he won't advertise any plans for Iran, but he says containment is not an option. The leaders of 25 European countries have signed a new treaty designed to prevent the 17 members of the Eurozone from living beyond their means. The rules call for budget discipline in an effort to avoid a repeat of the region's crippling debt crisis. Britain and the Czech Republic refused to sign the pact. More from our Friday roundtable coming up on the Daily Circuit.
Programming is supported by BNSF Railway, whose thousands of Minnesota employees are dedicated to safety and efficiency while protecting the environment. BNSF. The engine that connects us.
Join Garrison Keillor for A Prairie Home Companion at the State Theater this spring with all the regulars. Tim Russell, Sue Scott, the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, and the news from Lake Wobegon. Tickets go on sale Tuesday. Visit prairiehome.org for details.
Call in with your comments, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
And you can also reach me on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. It's our Friday roundtable, Dessa Britt Robson and Bob Collins in the studio today to talk about media and politics and any of the other developing stories that we've all noted over the course of the week. Bob, I saw this when you wrote it with Grover Norquist. I'm glad you're here so that we can talk about this. We heard when Minnesota Public Radio aired, it was at noon earlier this week, a speech by Grover Norquist, who had been in town to speak to the White Bear Lake Chamber of Commerce or something, right? We got a lot of blowback from airing the speech. Who did we hear from, and what were some of the things that they were saying?
Listeners, basically. And when I wrote about it, I reached no conclusion because I'm very conflicted.
Are you?
Given the
why?
Yeah.
Well, why are you conflicted? You mean that we should not
for the,
air
for
it?
For all of the reasons that Brett just outlined a couple of minutes ago, and that is the speech. It's a staple of public radio. Broadcasting a speech, it goes back, you know, generations, right, to national or to the National Press Club and everything else, and it's based on the fact that you're hearing more than an edited clip. You're hearing the whole shebang in the hour that we have available, and if somebody goes 55 minutes, then they go 55 minutes, and there's not much room to pick it apart, and there's not much interest, frankly, in picking it apart. And so when Norquist spoke for, and he's no dummy, he spoke for like 57 minutes. There was no, because there never is on these sorts of things, you know, fact-checking going on or a Mystery Science Theater 3000-like thing going on, and people objected to having to – some people objected to having to listen
but
to it.
But the idea is he's one part of the whole.
We would
air President Obama's speech. Yeah. And we have,
right,
or his press conferences,
and then you'd follow it though with some analysis or you know, or something like that on a typical political speech.
Or I mean, I think that what you do is you find somebody, the left side equivalent of Grover Norquist, if you're doing that. I do.
Well, but then the question becomes: now have you created the speech version of he said, she said?
That's right.
Except
exactly.
That. I think that there's a difference between somebody saying something. If you talk for 55, 57 minutes, you are having to get in some kind of depth about how you feel. I think that kind of depth, let the listeners themselves figure out exactly what's going on.
Exactly.
What bothers me more than anything else, to be honest with you, is this echo chamber aspect of you know, Andrew Breitbart recently died, and there was a lot of talk about him one way or another. And, you know, people say, you know, you don't speak ill of the dead or whatever. And in this particular thing, one of the few nice things I can say about Andrew Breitbart is that he was willing to engage people
That's
who disagreed
exactly
with
right.
him in the
exactly.
forum. He was, you know, unlike a Rush Limbaugh who refuses to let anybody, any callers, anybody disagree with him. When has Rush Limbaugh ever been challenged on an extended basis?
But Breitbart relished that.
Yes. And I think, I mean, there's obviously you know, he called Ted Kennedy a piece of human excrement on the day that, you know, Ted Kennedy died. So it's okay to speak badly of Andrew Breitbart. But I think that what he has done, he gets into the arena and he's, you know, a back and forth is okay. There needs to be some substance behind it. But if you have two people going at each other, that's what people need much more than an echo chamber.
Let me grab a call here from Roy in Minneapolis. Hi, Roy. You wanted to talk about Grover Norquist?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't think there is any counterpart on the left that you could put up against Grover Norquist. I mean, I think that's the truth that the media needs to speak to here. I'm glad you aired the speech, and I could hear this appalling swindler. That's what I call him. He's bamboozling people into thinking he can get a free lunch, something for nothing. And people want to believe that, of course. And he's highly successful. And so the truth that needs to be told is how influential he really is. And he told himself how he's hijacking the Republican Party and defining it narrowly and moving that whole thing to the right, and practically laughing about taking money off the table and destroying the Democratic coalition.
But here's the thing. But Roy, here's the thing about Grover Norquist. He does none of this surreptitiously. He's very open about the pledge that he requires politicians to take if they're going to get his support and people who believe in him in these individual districts. I mean, he is not smoke and mirrors out there about what he thinks. Bob, I wanted to, here's a listener who replied to a post that you put up about this, who said that you would waste valuable airtime on NPR to provide a platform is highly offensive to me. The vast majority of us are aware of what he would say, and none of his devoted fans will ever become NPR listeners. That was from Greg in Alexandria.
Right.
I kind of think he misses the point.
I'll counter that with another comment that said, I'm not a moron, and I like having my own beliefs and perceptions challenged because it forces me to back them up with logic. Listening to a combative five-minute interview with Norquist might help convince me that he's a wingnut, but it doesn't force me to think about my own values at all.
Mm. Put it this way, 57 minutes of Grover Norquist caused the person who just called in to deepen his political activism against the type of people that Grover Norquist is seeking to support. I would much rather Grover Norquist be talking to people who disagree with him than giving him 57 minutes on Fox News so that everybody in that particular nation can pat themselves on the back for being right that there is a free lunch in this country.
All right. Let me. Did you want to add something, Dessa?
Go ahead. Just the idea, do I like this? That question seems like the inappropriate question to be posing. Is this news? Is it relevant?
Right.
And is it important for me to know, to be civically engaged? Seems like the question. I caught a bit of that speech and I was glad to do it. I'm no Norquist fan, unsurprisingly, right? But I was really glad to hear firsthand so that I had the opportunity to shape my own beliefs. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the echo chamber, Britt, that you've mentioned a couple times.
Well, I think that, you know, it's a kind of the cliche that truth is the cleanser or whatever. But I mean, the more information that's credible and accurate that gets out there, I think the better the debate is. And I think that in this particular case, even if Grover Norquist is saying things that many people might regard as inaccurate, what is accurate is that his philosophy is being espoused in an hour-long format, so people know exactly where Grover Norquist stands. He's on the record. And as you said, it's not like the Koch brothers funding something behind the scenes.
Right.
And not to go too meta, but the conversation that didn't happen after his speech is happening now.
Yeah, that's right. So, Bob, are you through being conflicted and we've persuaded you?
Oh, I've never I make a good living being conflicted. So.
On to the phones to Steve in Minneapolis. Hi, Steve. I appreciate you waiting. Hey, Steve, are you there?
Yep.
Okay. What'd you want to say?
I've got a couple of points to make about things that have been said already. One is that I think the entire political spectrum in the last 40 years has shifted to the right. And I'll give you two examples of that. One is the fact that a Republican president in the early 1970s put on wage and price controls, which if a Democrat attempted to do that now would be laughed out of Congress. And the other thing is that the top tax rate for individual earners was 60% to 90% from 1913 until 1980, until Reagan cut it to 35. And since that time, the whole debate has been where in the 30s it should be. So I think that the right has pulled harder than the left has over the last 40 years.
Okay. What else did you want to say?
And the other thing is I've got a friend who's got two teenage kids who listen to the rock and roll lyrics that are just totally demeaning to men and women and everybody on the earth. And how is it that that person, how is it that he can handle an 11 and a 15-year-old and encourage them to listen to more, interesting hip-hop?
Okay. We know who that's
called. It's called A Badly Broken Code, and it's available on... No. to answer the second question, and then I'll surrender the floor. But as to that violence in music, in preparing for the presentation tonight at Augsburg, I've been more careful about issuing general statements of condemnation than I think I ever have before. Crime and Punishment is a story of unrepentant murder. Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues is too. Violence and sex play important roles in our stories. That said, institutionalizing cultures of hate and debasement doesn't sound like a healthy artistic sphere, because it doesn't sound like a healthy cultural sphere. There are a lot of hypersexualized, violent, and almost inexcusably materialistic messages in a lot of pop music. I'd say don't baby in bathwater it, though. There's a lot of amazing music here, and I don't say this in a self-serving kind of message. If you don't like my stuff, I don't care. I hope you find something that you do like. If you're wondering kind of how to get plugged into that music, there are a couple of blogs that are great primers here. City Pages is a great source of music. The Current, quite obviously, can be a great source for music as well. I'd say set 2 hours aside. Go through some playlists, even if it's just best artist of 2011, 10, and 9 locally on The Current. And I think you'd find some great alternatives. And if it means making them a mixtape, you know, maybe that's the move.
Hey, Dessa, on Twitter here, a listener says, I just saw Ice-T's VH1 documentary, Planet Rock, Hip Hop and the Crack Generation. Mm-hmm. Have you seen it?
I haven't. I just saw an excerpt in my on YouTube, to be honest, in my research, but I haven't seen it in its entirety.
Do you have any idea what the argument is?
I don't know I don't know what his basic tenets are. What does the Twitter writer
asking you what your thoughts are on that? Britt, you haven't seen it, have you?
Ask me next week. I'll check it out. Yeah.
But I guess I would argue that, as with anything, parents have to trust the depth of love and commitment to parenting that they have. And if they have, if they love their child and they are committed to being a good parent, I think overwhelmingly they will teach their children how to sort these things out. I mean, what we have to keep remembering is that one person's social justice is another person's anarchy. You know, back in the late 80s or maybe early 90s, there was a group called NWA that put
out
a record
writing that down.
Called F the Police, you know. and it was scabrous and very anti-authority. But in Los Angeles, policemen were, you know, abusing their power over African-American youths and in cities across the country. And it struck a chord with people. Now, it was a very, very violent. The group was very violent. They pioneered a whole form called gangster rap. But some good came out of that.
Yeah, but I think that sounds like a pretty good line. One person's social justice is another person's anarchy.
But
I don't either. I mean, I can look at the social justice that is going on and should be going on around the levels of incarceration of people of color. That's social justice. It's very necessary. And I don't think there's anybody that would step in and say there's something anarchical about that.
And I would cede immediately, Britt, but before going on, that I think that there's been a lot of efforts probably made under the banner of social justice.
Yes, exactly.
That, given a little bit of distance and some historical perspective, we realize, oh, that was not very social justice-y. So I think you're right. But on the other hand, when you talk about like the Rockefeller laws in New York, LL Cool J and Puffy coming out to support re-examining and lessening those drug controls, because 35% of a population is being incarcerated for very often nonviolent drug offenses. That is potentially a great example of social justice. I think also when I watched Brother Ali, who had on your show,
right?
He texted me, "Hey Des, you're free to do something called the Day of Dignity in North Minneapolis." I'll be frank, I have very little experience in North Minneapolis. I'm embarrassed to say how seldom I've been there. That's so stupid. And his effort brought me there. I met a lot of the people from his mosque. That is social justice, I think, happening. He feeds 300 people a week, every week. So I don't mean to rant and rave about all the do-gooderness, but the idea that it's tough in the moment to figure out what social justice is not an argument for the non-existence therein, or that everything's relative.
And I think that my statement was probably misconstrued. What I meant by that was that I think a lot of people hearing NWA say F the Police regard it as anarchy. And that what I'm saying is that sometimes messages are received by the public as being this horrible thing that need to be banned, when in fact, in the greater picture of things, they wind up doing some social good. I think that the Los Angeles Police Department, to some extent, has been cleaned up as a result of some of this blowback.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you can think of an example. But hang on just one second, Bob.
That's right.
Example of what?
Of what you just said about it looks anarchical at the time.
Well,
but
the gangster rap movement in general, I think people regarded it as simply this totally hedonistic, gleefully into violence thing. And what it was a protest against the conditions a lot of these people were living under. I mean, it's the same old argument of when does a terrorist become a national leader? I mean, on a global scale, you know, Menachem Begin or whatever. There, if you feel oppressed about something enough to, you know, go at something, and you're effective, you get to rewrite the history.
No, Bob, you can't step out of this. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say something that's going to derail what is one of the best conversations I've ever heard. I just wanted to go back to the caller's original point about the swing to the right and him pointing out that the wage and price controls of the 70s wouldn't be allowed today. I don't think that's true at all. I think you have to understand the 70s and what it was like when the paycheck you got last week literally was worth almost nothing the next week. And so the wage and price controls were a Hail Mary pass for the economic times in the same way that the economic stimulus of 2008, 2009 was a Hail Mary for a different sort of economy and a different sort of problem. See, I told you I didn't want to interrupt.
But his greater point.
I thought you were going to say something. Yeah.
I think his greater
profound,
point about
right?
the politics of the last 40 years, I don't think anybody would argue this is we're talking pre-Reagan revolution. It has moved to the right in this country. I mean, is there any disagreement about that? You compare 40 years ago was, 1982. We were in the middle of Reagan's second year in office. Since that time, you know, we've had two relatively centrist Democratic presidents. And I would argue people who have really pushed this nation to the right in the Republican Party.
72, right? 40 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, 40 years, right. Sorry. Yeah, there you go.
I only said that because I thought, how old am I? And was I? So that wasn't
graduated.
That wasn't
high school in 72.
Well, let me grab a call here, I think, to come back to music to Yoni in Minneapolis. Do you know? Hi.
Hey, everybody.
Hi. Hey, Yoni. Yoni is the artist who first invited me into hip hop.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hi.
Oh, stop. You flatter me. Mm-hmm. So I want to make it quick because I'm sure there's a lot of callers and a lot of people who have something to say, but I wanted to make a quick point regarding music and the current state of hip-hop music in particular in regards to a prior caller's concern. I think anytime there is a popular musical movement that is created organically amongst the people who started it because they needed to start it as an answer to what they were dealing with in their lives or their communities, anytime this movement gains traction, like it did in the 80s with hip-hop, mm-hmm. the corporate world takes notice and realizes eventually that there's a way to capitalize on it if it can be repackaged and reformed in a way that's more palatable to a wider audience. And to do that, to turn something that's pretty organic into something that is a commodity, they have to figure out what sells. Mm. And mm-hmm. in this world, sex and violence sell. And so I feel like if you want someone to blame the people who are trying to make money off of this. And if you want someone to prove to you that it's not all about guns and misogyny, then I think you need to dig deeper into the originators of the genre, whether it's hip hop or country music or anything else, to see, to find out what's really there, the real meat of it, and not just corporate America's answer to it.
Okay, so, but Yoni, hang on one second. No, stay with us, because when you say blame the people who are trying to make money off of this, the record companies, what, the artists themselves, who?
No, that is a very good point. Obviously, you can't just make a blanket statement that all record companies are out to just turn real art into a commodity. I think there's a lot of record companies that have taken these styles and brought them out to the world And so that was kind of a blanket statement, and I do apologize for that. But I would say it's the larger movement of trying to turn an organic artistic movement into a larger commodity that can be sold to anyone that can, or whether they can or can't relate to that original movement. I feel like that's where that's what turns what I feel pure art and good art into something that has been perverted.
Mm-hmm. Hey, stay with us for a minute. I want to hear what Dessa has to say about this.
This argument, Yoni, I think is valuable but limited. And I think it runs parallel a little bit to those conversations about original intent. The Constitution is an active living document, and hip hop didn't stop in 88. And we can't, I don't think, only continue to go back to the originators and the founders for guidance. It's moved. It's 30 years later. Mm-hmm. We've got to acknowledge it's on the ground. Moreover, a lot of the a lot of the people who are profiting in big ways are artists. Not all of them, and I think they're still in the minority, but when you look at moguls like 50 Cent, Jay-Z, Dame Dash, like, you have a lot of people who are making money who are content originators. And stepping back even from that statement, because I know that there's a lot of rented Escalades, I would say that it would be paternalistic of us to not at some point hold people accountable for their messaging.
The artists themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At some point, if you're desperate, okay, tell me about it. But after you made that first, that first 100,000, I'll be very frank. My friends and I, for many years, live all right off 25K. I've lived a little less comfortably off 18. If you care about what you're doing, you can make it happen. Does that mean that you shouldn't strive for security? Absolutely not. Does greed corrupt? Absolutely. At some point, though, we got to say, hey, man, if my argument is they don't know any better, then we're not thinking very much of the people who are creating that content. And it sounds a lot like a superiority complex to me.
Brett?
Well, I think that, again, it gets to who you're trying to address. I think if you are trying to make all the money in the world, then you're going to go in the direction of making all the money in the world, and you're going to see what sells. Those artists, I think, generally speaking, unless they adopt the signature thing, don't tend to last. And if they do tend to last, they tend to be co-opted. I mean, I'm thinking of a guy like Snoop Dogg Ice-T is now on, Law and Order, for God's sake. And, Ice Cube is in movies for kids, It's all part of the great American capitalist system, and people get their foot in the door and they go. I mean, on the other hand, you got a guy, Common, who I regard as a very conscious rapper, and I enjoy a lot of his music. He's made some missteps along the way. But there's a guy, he's on, television as well. People have learned that hip-hop is a way into a greater culture and a way to expand their earnings and their notoriety. And in this celebrity-drenched culture, that can happen. On the other hand, I do think that you can make, hip-hop and partying and social message, public enemies fight the power. Gil Scott Heron's Johannesburg. There's a lot of examples of the two being conjoined.
I have to say, I know it's a great conversation when Bob is doing more listening than talking.
I can't believe this. I haven't felt like this since Buddy Guy was playing 10 feet from me.
Thank you all for a fantastic conversation. Please come back.
Thank you, Sessa.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Britt Robson, thank you. Bob, as always.
Thanks.
Great to have you here. We've got the latest news now from Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. With Syrian troops now in control of a neighborhood in the city of Homs that had been held by rebels, Government forces are being accused of carrying out execution-style killings and burning homes. There have been growing fears of revenge attacks after yesterday's pullout by the rebels. The Red Cross has reached the city but has not yet entered the neighborhood in which hundreds died in weeks of shelling. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says New Jersey officials' complaints about NYPD surveillance of Muslim groups are ridiculous. He was responding to criticism from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Newark Mayor Cory Booker over the department's tactics. Bloomberg said today on his weekly radio show that it's a bit ridiculous to say the NYPD would stop at the border. He says New York police officers have been doing in New Jersey what any private citizen can do, going to open meetings and looking at websites. More next on The Daily Circuit.
Today's question is supported by Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America, which is helping promote a greener community through its 2011 Energy Star Certified headquarters in Golden Valley. Allianz, for all that's ahead. Online at allianzlife.com.
Now for the Daily Circuit Rewind, sounds and conversations that you might have missed. We started the week with a big bang, literally. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson on moon colonies, asteroids swinging way too close to Earth, and who'd be up for a one-way ticket to Mars?
And you can say, who's going to do this, and you risk being exposed to a dose of radiation? You know, the line will still be wrapped around the block, because the payoff on that risk is you're one of the first people to walk on Mars. This talk that we live in risk-averse times, that's another delusion. We're risk-averse because the challenge is not to do what no one has ever done before. If there's a 2% chance I'm going to die by going into the space shuttle, because we lost two shuttles out of 100 or so, if it's 2% chance I'm going to die and all I get to do is go where hundreds have gone before, that is not a good enough risk for me to take. So I tell you, if you say we could do the experiment tomorrow, say who wants to go to Mars and not come back, but you'll be the first ones to do that. The line will be wrapped around the block.
No, really?
Would you sign up for that? There are people who you've seen these people. These are the people who jump out of perfectly good airplanes with the parachute. These are people who rock climb. I read this, I didn't re-verify it, but that the deadliest year in Mount Everest's history, where the most number of people died, the year after that had the greatest number of climbers ever. The risk of death is something that attracts a subset of the human species, provided that risk comes along with a great achievement that they could be within reach for having done so. And it's those are the folks who were the first to leave the cave and cross the valley and climb the mountain. And I'm happy and proud that such folks live among us. It doesn't have to be everybody. It just has to be some of us. And they're the ones who we build statues to when they come back and even if they don't come back.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson on a one-way flight to Mars. Sounds like a Hollywood movie, doesn't it? This is the Daily Circuit Rewind, interviews and sounds that you might have missed. Speaking of Hollywood and extraterrestrials, how come filmmakers can create the most convincing Martians, monsters, even car chases, but they can't seem to get it right when it comes to the news? Now, I still remember Michelle Pfeiffer playing Tally Atwater, who was really supposed to be Jessica Savage in the movie Up Close and Personal. Tally did an entire live shot in the midst of a prison riot with a photographer who was connected to nothing. No cables, no live shot truck, no satellite, nothing. Here's On the Media's Bob Garfield.
You know what Hollywood is really good at faking? Gunshot wounds. Also, ocean liner sinkings. D-Day landings. Car chases. And even ill-fated moon voyages.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
They can do train wrecks and surgery and ballet, bank jobs and death camps and Spider-Men. But damn if they can get the evening news.
Whether suicide or homicide, the sport and the city lost a well-loved and once revered hero.
This is Media Break. You give us 3 minutes and we'll give you the world.
Good morning. I'm Casey Wong with Jess Perkins.
When it comes to faithfully depicting the look and feel of a newscast, Hollywood nearly always can't. I asked New York Magazine film critic David Edelstein if, for instance, movies and TV shows ever get the style of news copy right.
No.
Do they get the cadence right?
Never.
Do they get the set design right?
20 years ago, right.
Lighting?
No.
hair, wardrobe, anything?
No.
It's not just that movies and TV shows get it wrong. They get it wrong in so many ways. Morning Glory falls in the subcategory of Hollywood movies about TV news. Harrison Ford plays a hard-bitten network anchor, suddenly miscast as a morning show host. He plays opposite co-anchor Diane Keaton, who, I must say, nails her character cold.
Coming up next, you've heard her sing. Well, today, you're going to hear about her sweet tooth. Join us as we bake brownies with Celine Dion's personal chef. All that and more coming up on Daybreak.
We did a kind of boot camp with Harrison and with Diane.
Morning Glory director Roger Michel.
We took them to sort of school for presenters. They learned how to read a teleprompter, how to change cameras. The basic grammar that we take for granted about news presenters. Diane particularly loved it and responded to it and loved kind of peering behind the facade.
Ford, whose character is supposed to exude mega gravitas, was not so quick a study.
Federal authorities have been planning this raid for weeks. This reporter has learned that the indictment contains 15 counts of racketeering and using undue influence. Mike Pomeroy, Daybreak.
Back to you in the studio.
This is the Daily Circuit Rewind, conversations that you might have missed, and I'm Carrie Miller. Actress Viola Davis did not win Best Actress at the Oscars last Sunday, but her co-star Octavia Spencer won her category of Best Supporting Actress.
I share this with everybody. Thank you, Steven Spielberg, for changing my life. Thank you, Stacey Snyder, for changing my life. Please wrap up. I'm wrapping up. I'm sorry. I'm freaking out.
But a week after those Oscars went home with the winners, there is still a debate going on as to whether Davis and Spencer should have accepted the roles of black maids. Here's NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
By now, millions of moviegoers have heard this mantra. It's from a black maid who's trying to instill confidence and compassion in a white toddler she cares for.
You is kind, you is smart, you is important. You is smart, you is kind, you is important. That's so good.
Viola Davis has been both lauded for her skill and lashed at for playing a maid, Abilene Clark, in The Help. When she visited the set of The View, Davis told Barbara Walters she'd braced herself for criticism when she took the role.
You knew there was going to be a backlash from the African-American community. It is a story set in 1962 about maids who are not educated. Mm-hmm. And I thought that people would look at that and they wouldn't see the work.
In fact, most people who saw the work praised it. But that didn't stop some black folks from wishing aloud that Davis could have been wonderful in some other role. That might be the decades-old residue from when Hattie McDaniel became the first black actor to receive an Oscar for her supporting role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. And may I say thank you and God bless you.
For talk show host Tavis Smiley, Davis's role as a maid doesn't feel like much progress.
There's something that sticks in my craw about celebrating Hattie McDaniel so many years ago for playing a maid. Here we are all these years later, and I want you to win, mm-hmm. but I'm ambivalent about what you're winning for.
Davis isn't having it.
That very mindset that you have and that a lot of African Americans have is absolutely destroying the black artists.
Davis told Fresh Air host Terry Gross that a maid can be a meaty role in the right hands.
You're only reduced to a cliche if you don't humanize a character. A character can't be a stereotype based on the character's occupation.
That's actress Viola Davis on her role as a maid in the film The Help. This is the Daily Circuit Rewind, interviews and conversations you might have missed. Finally, European rambler Rick Steves sets off on a road trip tomorrow, roaming the back roads of places like Oklahoma, Iowa, and Florida. Turns out he knows a lot more about Italy's Cinque Terre than the wide open spaces of places like Nebraska. Here's what he said about it.
I love just to be in a new place with people who are proud of their town and their heritage and to pick up that sort of enthusiasm they have for their corner of the world. And I've always got my little notepad in my pocket and I'll be taking a lot of notes. Normally when I'm traveling, I'm taking notes in Europe to help my guidebooks and my TV show scripts and that sort of thing. Right. And this will be different. It won't really contribute directly to my work as a travel writer focusing on Europe, but it's going to give me a real appreciation for the diversity and the beauty of our country. And there's a lot of, I mean, I'm a little spoiled because in Europe, you know, you're sitting on Roman ruins, and here our history doesn't go back so far. But there's more diversity in this country than I think a lot of people realize, and there's certainly a lot of warm welcomes and a lot of natural beauty.
So when you say diversity, what do you mean?
Cultural diversity.
You're right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, subtle things, but real things. I mean, what do you know, dialects, what do people eat, what are people's outlooks? I think the outlook thing is really interesting, and I'm just fascinated by how your terrain contributes to your worldview. I often think about, with my work, I get to travel a lot, and I spend 4 months a year in Europe updating guidebooks and working on our guided tours and our TV shows, and I've got a circle of friends there, and I go back and update things, but the downside of it is I can't go to new places, and it really is so refreshing to go to new places, and a lot of us get into a nice little routine where every year we go back to Hawaii or we go back to, you know, Baja, California or whatever, and it's nice to just shake it up a little bit, I think, and I think for me, it's high time I got in the car and shook it up.
Traveler and writer Rick Steves, I suggested some reading material for his journey. Someone tweeted to say he certainly couldn't hit the road without a soundtrack. Here's one of the tunes we suggest that Rick download to his iPod. In the USA. Let's go get lost, let's go get lost. Blue, you sit so pretty west of the one. Sparkle like with yellow icing just a mirror. That's the rewind for the week, and this is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News. Just a mirror for the sun.